Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode 30 of our monthly Meet the Experts Q&A session with Cinten's employment team. As I always say at this point, thank you so much for all your positive comments about these sessions, for continuing to sign into them, continuing to send in your questions in absolute droves, and obviously for watching the video online afterwards and listening to the podcasts. We are delighted that these sessions continue to add value, and we don't in any way take your listenership for granted. Just moving the slides on. Our speakers this morning are Angela Carver and Emily Richardson from the employment team, who you can see there in front of you. And as with previous sessions, they are going to be answering three questions. Emily is going to deal with questions one and two. So without any further ado, pass you straight over to Emily. Emily, good morning.
Morning, David, and thank you to everyone joining the Q&A today. So we usually have three questions, but today we have two that I'll be answering, and then I'll pass you on to Angela to discuss the final topic. So the final topic is the end to mandatory isolation periods, which was introduced this week. And as you might have seen, Angela spoke about this topic on Look North on Monday when the news was announced. So today she'll go into a little bit more detail about what to expect and how it will impact on things going forwards. So the two questions today relate to recruitment after redundancy and exercising a pile-on clause when dismissing an employee who has exhausted sick pay. So looking at the first question, can an employer recruit after a redundancy, and if so, when? So there's no set period that an employer can't recruit after making redundancies, but the point where it will be appropriate to do so will depend on certain facts. And this is because in some situations, if an employer recruits for the same or substantially similar roles to the one that's just been made redundant, then it could affect the fairness of any dismissals made, and it may also give rise to claims by redundant employees. And there are certain aspects that ex-employees will focus on in their claims. So there's things that employers must do before they consider recruiting again. So the first thing that an employee could argue is that there wasn't a genuine redundancy situation at the time of their dismissal, if the role that's now being advertised is the same as the one that they performed. So remember that before dismissing employees for reason of redundancy, an employer must be satisfied that the statutory definition applies. And this definition identifies three circumstances. So that's business closure, workplace closure, and the diminished requirements of the business for employees to do work of a particular kind. So if redundancies are made because there's a diminished requirement, for example, and then an employer goes on to recruit for the same or similar role, this might suggest that the redundancy wasn't genuine, and the employee could then argue unfair dismissal. Another potential aspect that an employee could argue is that even if there was a genuine redundancy situation, the fairness of their dismissal was compromised as the employer failed to consider reducing costs in other ways before they thought about redundancy. So dismissal is more likely to be considered fair if an employer has considered whether it's at all possible to reduce or avoid the need for dismissals. And this is actually one of the matters that employers must consult representatives about in a collective redundancy situation anyway. So to ensure that this has happened, employers might consider things such as voluntary redundancies, a recruitment freeze, withdrawing new job offers or deferring new joiners, reducing agency staff, redeploying or seconding staff, and also early retirement as well. And whilst this is obviously entirely fact dependent, a tribunal might ask questions if an employer hasn't addressed alternatives until after the selection was made. So it's important to be able to evidence this. Of course, there are reasons why it wouldn't work. So for example, if there's evidence that actually it wouldn't make the savings that were needed quick enough. But what's important is that employers must consider them. And actually here in this situation, employers might need to further discuss consulting on alternatives at this point. A further point to be aware of is that an employee could also argue unfair dismissal if their employer should have offered a new role to them as alternative employment, or that they failed to make a reasonable search for any alternative employment. So this would obviously depend on the nature of the new role compared to the redundant role. whether it could be deemed to be the same or similar, and also whether there's a crossover of skills that should be considered. But employers must show that they've taken this into account and considered this. Having said all of that, it is of course possible that there was both a redundancy situation that was genuine, but now there's a new role which requires recruitment. And this is likely to happen in circumstances, for example, where shortly after an employee was made redundant, the employee wins new business that it wasn't expecting, or if someone resigns, meaning that the employee needs to recruit. So there was a legitimate redundancy situation, but that disappeared and the situation has now changed. In this scenario, if the previous employment has already terminated at that point of the new recruitment, then there wouldn't be an obligation on the employer to offer it to the redundant employee as alternative employment. And there genuinely would be a situation here where an employer could recruit. So the kind of general takeaway in this situation is that to be safe against unfair dismissal claims, if there is going to be recruitment for the same or similar roles, then an employer needs to show that the redundancies were genuine and avoidable at the time, but that now that financial position and or the general position of the company as a whole has changed, and that change wasn't foreseeable at the time. So moving on to the next question, if an employee has exhausted sick pay and has a long notice period, will the pylon be exercised on the basis that the employee receives no payment? So when an employee is off sick, they can be in receipt of statutory sick pay for up to 28 weeks if they're eligible. And they may also be entitled to contractual or company sick pay if that's provided by their employer. But if an employer wants to dismiss an employee who has exhausted this sick pay, and they want to exercise a payment in lieu of notice clause, then the length of the employee's notice entitlement will determine how this type of clause is dealt with. So employees have a statutory minimum notice period, which must be given by the employer. And that's if they've been employed for more than 1 month, but less than 2 years continuously, then it's at least a week. And if they've been employed for 2 years or more, then it's 1 week for each complete year up to a maximum of 12 weeks. But employers can also give employees a notice entitlement in excess of that statutory minimum through the contract. And if this is the case, then the pylon clause would operate differently in this situation. So looking first at if an employee is contractually entitled to receive at least 1 week more than that statutory minimum, then their entitlement to pay during that period will be the same as if they weren't under notice. So what this means is that their entitlement is governed entirely by the sick pay provisions in their contract. So if they've exhausted all their sick pay and they're not in receipt of any pay at all, then they're also not entitled to any pay during their notice period either. So in terms of the actual pylon clause, whilst there isn't clear authority on exactly how to deal with this in this situation, in the first instance, you would need to look at the contractual wording of the pylon clause and whether or not it specifies how this is to be dealt with. If it does provide that the employee is entitled to the pylon based on basic pay, then it might be argued that the employer can only exercise this clause if it makes payment of normal basic pay for the whole period. So even though the employee is off sick, so wouldn't have received that basic pay if they'd been employed anyway during that notice period. But if it doesn't specify how the payment is to be calculated, then the tribunal would ultimately need to interpret the contract and make a decision on that interpretation. And this was the case in a 2011 case of Locke v. Candy and Candy, where an employee had been summarily dismissed, but had argued that he was entitled to his contractual bonus, which he would have received if he'd remained employed during that notice period. But as I said, the pylon clause was silent on what was included. So the Court of Appeal looked at the wording and determined here that because the contract also stated that he must have been employed by the company to receive the bonus, then his appeal was dismissed. And so the importance of the wording is really clear here. So that's if the notice period is at least a week longer than the statutory entitlement. But if the notice period is not at least a week longer than the entitlement through statute, then the entitlement would be the same, they would be entitled to full pay during their notice period. Okay, so that's the end of the questions. So I'll now pass you on to Angela for the third topic.
Thanks, Emily. I am going to have a little talk around the aspect of self-isolation and the rules that changed just yesterday. So most of you will undoubtedly be aware that as of yesterday, it's no longer a legal requirement to self-isolate if you test positive for COVID-19 or if you've been in contact with somebody with COVID-19. So what's happened is the legal requirement has been replaced with guidance where it's hoped that the general public will take a sensible view if they contract COVID-19. So, but from my perspective, with free testing ending on the 1st of April and statutory sick pay reverting to the pre-pandemic form on the 24th of March, that being that SSP is now payable from day 4 of sickness absence rather than day 1, it could really create a scenario where some workers cannot afford to take a test. I think the rumour is going to be that a pack of tests is around £20 to £30, and therefore they unknowingly bring COVID-19 into the workplace. Or we could be in a situation where workers avoid taking tests altogether, or they don't communicate a positive test because they can't afford to be absent without pay. So as an employee, you need to manage the workspace and be mindful of your duty to protect the health and safety of those who come onto your premises. Now, it's very important to understand that each workforce is different, and as such, every approach that's taken by an employer will be different. Your workforce might have employees who are clinically extremely vulnerable or immunosuppressed, for example, or it could be that they are taking care of individuals at home who are also immunosuppressed. So as an employer, your starting point is to review the health and safety risk assessment that hopefully, if you've been listening to these Q&As, you already have in place to reflect the probability that COVID-19 will very likely come into your workplace. And if you haven't already done it, it's important to undertake an individual risk assessment for your vulnerable members of staff. Now, if you do have vulnerable members of staff, you do need to be mindful that these individuals could qualify as disabled under the Equality Act. And as such, you may need to accommodate reasonable adjustments for that individual. Now, this could be a temporary or a permanent adjustment. The important thing to note is it's not an automatic right that you do need to make reasonable adjustments. You need to look at what you've got in place that puts that individual at a disadvantage compared to their colleagues without a disability, and what you can reasonably put in place to avoid any disadvantage. Now, it could be that an individual with a disability who is at a genuine risk if they contract COVID-19 could benefit from having, for example, an individual office. They could work from home more longer term. You could amend their hours to reduce peak times on public transport. And what we've tend to find with our employers is that they're seeking occupational health advice in relation to adjustments which would benefit that individual. Another thing that our clients have found ever increasing, actually, in particular since last year, are applications for flexible working. And if you can facilitate these requests, this can actually alleviate some angst that's held amongst employees returning to the workplace. Now, a lot of employees are adopting a 60-40 approach to home working on either side of the fence, actually, so 60% in the office, 40% at home, or vice versa. And what this does is it automatically reduces your footfall within the office, and it allows for natural social distancing. Now, we do have a seminar taking place on the 7th of April, and that's got a focus on flexible working requests and hybrid working. And if your business would benefit from a more in-depth review of this situation and hybrid working, you should sign up and come along to our seminar, and David will explain to you how to sign up at the end of this Q&A. Now, clearly, hybrid working is not something which can be accommodated in every industry. For example, with our healthcare, manufacturing, retail and hospitality clients, it's just not feasible or possible. So in these environments, it's sensible to consider, for example, reintroducing or maintaining safety measures which have been in place previously. This, for example, could be things like face masks, one-way systems, and limiting numbers in confined spaces such as the kitchens or the bathrooms. Now, these changes won't be right for every workplace, but it is worth considering these after reviewing your risk assessment and what works for you. Now, it's also worth considering, and there's a lot of considerations this morning, I'm aware of that, to have a COVID-19 policy in place advising your staff what to do in the event of them contracting COVID-19 or being in contact with somebody with COVID-19, and also considering changing contracts of employment. And that would instruct an employee to stay away from your business if they have COVID-19. Now, you do need to consider the length of the isolation period you might put in place and how you will pay your member of staff if you ask them to leave the workplace. Now, if this change is adopted and an employee then comes into the workplace when they are positive with COVID-19, they would be in breach of contract. And this could then likely result in a sanction after following your company disciplinary process. But each case is to be considered on its own merits. And the purpose of your disciplinary process is to understand the basis as to why an employee may be coming into work or perhaps might have misconstrued what you've got in place. Now, it's clear that despite your best efforts, you might still have staff who refuse to come into work, and contracts should stipulate the place of work. And it's a reasonable instruction from you as an employer to ask your employee to attend the workplace. Now, if this employee is quite hesitant and the situation occurs, what I would suggest is not jumping straight into disciplinary action, but communicate, talk through the concerns that an employee has. Because what we found over the last 12 months when employees are hesitant to come into the office is it usually arises from a misunderstanding as to the protection that you as an employer have put in place in the workplace. So we found that by sharing the outcome of a risk assessment and the mechanisms that you've put in place in the workplace can alleviate any concerns. But you might find that things don't always go to plan, and if this occurs, you know where we are. I will pass you over to David now, who will close off, but thank you to everybody who's attended this morning.
Thanks very much to both of you. Usually at this point, I just remind you that we are still working hard to deliver useful and relevant content, articles, blogs, podcasts, videos, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. And in about half an hour's time, that will include all 30 episodes of these monthly Q&A sessions. Social media, you can also follow the employment team on Twitter at SintonsHR. I've just popped our speakers' details back on the screen there. If you have anything you'd like to raise further, please don't hesitate to get in touch with them or a member of the team. Angela has just mentioned our employment seminar, which is on the 7th of April. It's being held from 8:30 a.m. at Newcastle Eagles. And if you'd like to sign up to that, you can either email me directly, david.pritchard@sintons.co.uk, or you can go to our website and search on the events section where you can sign up from there as well. Our next session will be with you Friday, the 25th of March, 2022 at 10 a.m. And as usual, I'll send the link round nearer the time. All that's left for us to say is thank you very much for listening. We wouldn't let Emily know before the session how many people had actually signed up. Emily, we're 7 short of 1,000. So just to let you know that, you can rest easy now. Thank you once again for listening. As I said at the outset, we don't take this for granted. Stay safe, everyone, and we'll speak to you next month.